Good evening. This is time to not necessarily reflect those of the station management, Tufts University administration, or the Board of Trustees. My show runs every Friday this summer from 6 to 8 p.m. Today is a very special show for me. This was a very important and influential podcast in my life when I first heard it several years ago. Jordan Peterson, his first appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience in November 2016. Almost 6 years ago, but the suggestions for finding direction are timeless, and I hope they will help you if you are in need as much as they helped me in my time of need. The conversation is the last two out of the 3 hours of episode 877 of the Joe Rogan Experience. Now, from November 2016, Jordan Peterson.
Things get to terrible places one tiny step at a time. You know, if I encroach on you and I'm sophisticated about it, I'm going to encroach 2 millimeters. I'm going to encroach right to the point where you start to protest. Then I'm going to stop. Then I'm going to wait. Then you're going to calm down. Then I'm going to encroach again right to the point where you protest. Then I'm going to stop. Then I'm going to wait. And I'm just going to do that forever. And before you know it, you're going to be back 3 miles from where you started, and you'll have done it one step at a time. And then you'll go, oh, how'd I get here? And the answer was, well, I pushed you a little farther than you should have gone, and you agreed. And so then I pushed you a little farther than you should have gone again, and you agreed. And if anybody's interested in this sort of process, and this is a horrifying book, if you want to read about how this process works, you can read a book called Ordinary Men by Robert Browning. And Ordinary Men is about, Browning was interested in how the Nazis trained how they train people to kill, basically. And so Robert Browning studied this police battalion. It's a very interesting book. So these were middle-aged German men. So they were raised and educated really before Hitler came to power. So they weren't indoctrinated Nazis. They were policemen. And when the Nazis went through Poland and then needed to impose their brand of order on Poland, they brought policemen in. They brought this battalion of middle-aged policemen in. And their commandant, their commander, was by all accounts a pretty decent guy, and he told them that because it was wartime, they were probably going to have to do some pretty terrible things, but that they could go home if they didn't think they were up to it. So there was no compulsion. You know, this wasn't a Milgram experiment or an experiment where you had to obey orders. The guy who was giving the orders said, look, this is going to be awful, but you can back off. But the guys thought, well, I'm not going to leave my comrades here to do the dirty work, you know, which is kind of a virtue in a perverse way. And then Browning details how they went from ordinary policemen to guys who were taking naked pregnant women out into the middle of the fields and shooting them in the back of the head. And they were physically ill during most of the transformation process. You know, they started out by rounding up the Jewish men between the ages of 16 and 65. Well, you know, you can kind of understand that because you're at war. And then, well, then they put them in stadiums. And then, well, then they had to shoot some of them. And then they had to load them on cattle cars. It was like one step at a time. These guys were having a dreadful time of it. They didn't stop. They didn't stop. And so that's how things get to where they are now, is that, I mean, I know they're not at that point, and I'm not trying to make the case that they're at that point.
Well, you're one of the first people that's sounding an alarm, that there's a real issue with controlling people. There's a real issue with controlling dialogue, controlling the way people communicate, and that these ideologies, although seemingly innocuous, they can take you down very dangerous roads.
Yes, well, seemingly innocuous ideology. Those words, innocuous ideology, those words do not go together. There are no innocuous ideologies. And they're forms of pathological oversimplification. And they're also clubs. I mean the kind of clubs that you hit people with as well as the clubs that you belong to. The advantage to me being an ideologue is that I can explain everything. I can feel morally superior. And I know who my enemies are. And you know what you're supposed to do with enemies. They're not your friends, right? You move against them. And, you know, we're approaching a situation, and this has already happened, I think, more in the United States than in Canada, although our countries are competing to see who can cross the idiot line fastest. You're in a situation in the U.S. where 50% of your population won't talk to the other 50%. That's not good. And I would say it's more pronounced on the left liberal side because they regard everybody who voted for Trump as essentially as an enemy. It's like, hey, people, that's 50% of your citizens. You might think about talking with them. You know, people you can't talk to, those are enemies.
Well, ironically, I really truly believe that one of the big factors in Trump's rise to power is that people are sick of this oversimplification and this ridiculous ideology coming from the left. Like that this enforcing
of identity politics.
Exactly. And so they've chosen an identity politics that opposes the identity politics that they think is disgusting.
Yeah, and that's just starting.
That's
right. Well, if you teach one side to play identity politics, de facto you teach the other side to play identity politics. And I've seen more and more people who are center people, as far as I'm concerned, pushed to the right.
Yes.
Because of the continual insistence that by their mere existence, they're part of the perpetrator group.
Just by being a white person who is somehow or another successful, you are a privileged person, you're part of the elite, you're part of the 1%, you're part of the problem.
Yeah, you're part of the oppressors.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You're an oppressor by being just a person with a home in the suburbs.
Well, and it's also extremely annoying for people who've worked really hard and who've made the requisite sacrifices to become successful along some dimension to have that immediately attributed to their oppression.
Yes.
And it's not obvious that that's something we want to do. It's like for the social justice warrior types out there who might be listening, it's like, are you really willing to say that every single person who's accomplished something has done that as a consequence of oppression? That's again what the Soviets claimed with regards to the successful peasants just before the 1920s. It's like, well, the peasants weren't emancipated. They were serfs until about 30 years before that. They were serfs. They were basically slaves. And some of them had clambered up to the point where maybe they owned their hut and a cow and could, you know, employ someone. Well, the Soviet claim was, well, that's all theft. You got that all because you're an oppressor. And so then the Soviet intellectuals went into the villages. And just imagine how this happened. So imagine a village, a small town where everyone knows everybody. And there's maybe 10, 20 people there who are moderately successful. Okay, and so you can imagine that those 20 people have like 100 enemies at the bottom of the socioeconomic distribution. Useless, horrible people who are jealous and resentful about the fact that these people have been successful. Okay, so now the intellectuals come in and say, property is theft, success is oppression. And then they look for the people in the village who are willing to move against those 20 successful people. Well, those guys at the bottom, those 100 resentful, jealous, murderous people at the bottom, they're just waiting for an opportunity to go kick down some doors. And that's exactly what they did in the 1920s. And as I said, they wiped out all their productive peasants. And then 6 million Ukrainians starved to death. They had posters. The Soviets produced posters in the 1930s that said, essentially, don't forget it's wrong to eat your children. So,
whoa.
Yeah, whoa. There's nothing about the Soviet, there's nothing that you can imagine that's horrible enough so that it matched the reality of what happened in the Soviet Union between 1919 and 1959. And, you know, the West knew about this, too. Early, Malcolm Muggeridge in the 30s was documenting for England, for English newspapers, exactly what was going on in the Soviet Union. The bloody intellectuals didn't admit it till the mid-70s, you know, with the exception of people like George Orwell. So,
why do these patterns repeat themselves? What is it about human beings?
Well, we like things simple. We like things simple. So, and then you often, like, a simple explanation is a good explanation unless it's too simple, but distinguishing between simple and too simple is no easy matter. We like to know who's our friend and who's our enemy, and we like the feeling of unearned moral superiority.
And then unearned moral superiority. That's the
why
the
earn it, man? Especially
right.
When there's no such thing as earning anyways. So, and then, I mean, there's deeper and darker things that are underneath that. It's like the human proclivity to pull down those who have more than you. It's like these kids on the campuses who are claiming identity with the oppressed, you know, at somewhere like Yale. It's like, how in the world you can speak of oppression if you happen to be at Yale is beyond me. I mean, first of all, you're North American, which puts you in the top 1%. And then of North Americans, you're in the top 1%. So you're in the top 1% of 1%. But yet you want that. You want to have all the power that goes along with that. And you want to have the moral superiority that comes from being a representative of the oppressed. So that's exactly what you want. You want all the power and you want all the victimization at the same time.
Well, Yale's a great example because Yale was one of what happened with the Halloween costume debacle at Yale was one of the first videos that was released that made people horrified, where they couldn't believe how students were communicating with professors.
Yeah, well, the student who screamed up a storm about that the male professor, mm-hmm. who was the husband of the woman who wrote the pro-Halloween costume letter, it turned out she was on the bloody hiring committee that hired him. One of the things she screamed was, "Who hired you?" It was like, well, it turned out it was you because you were on the committee just a few years before. I know, and they took, like, yeah, that was absolutely
appalling.
Explain
that to people that don't know what the hell we're talking about.
Well,
explain this debacle, because it really was about questionable Halloween costumes.
Well, it was about questioning Halloween costumes. Halloween costumes are part of the whole point of Halloween is to have questionable costumes, right? You play with death, right. For example, and decay and horror. And it's a time when the norms with regards to the expression of things that are outside of our normal behavior are suspended so that everybody can have a little celebration, as it turns out. Well, you know, campuses have got all upset about things like cultural appropriation. At Queen's University in Canada just the other week, they were going after students who were dressing up as Viet Cong, for example, or Mexicans. It's like, I just don't see what the hell's racist about dressing up like a Mexican. Mexicans have a traditional clothing. There's nothing wrong with Mexicans, so why is it wrong
exactly.
to dress up like them?
Right. And if you want to be Pancho Villa for Halloween, what's wrong with that?
Well, you can regard that as an homage just as much as a denigration. It's
absolutely.
Like, why is that such a problem?
Right. And,
but anyways, it doesn't matter because nothing's too trivial to be a problem to a social justice warrior, and because they don't like to deal with real problems. And Yale went after Halloween costumes.
So this woman wrote a letter saying maybe we should just relax about this stuff and, you know, not don't put restrictions on what people wear for Halloween, but let people decide what is and isn't offensive.
Yes, and well, and many Halloween costumes are offensive. That's the point.
But her letter was in really reasonable.
Yeah, it was perfectly reasonable. It was like an adult wrote it.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, all hell broke loose.
All hell broke
and
loose.
And she ended up quitting.
And I think he did. Did
no,
he
I don't
leave?
Think. I don't think he left. I don't think he left. But she did.
Seeing him bow down to this woman, screaming at him, swearing in his face. Was so disturbing. It was so humiliating. I felt so humiliated for him because she was screaming, "This is our home. What the f*** are you doing? You're not making this safe."
And it's not her bloody home. The university's not a home.
Right.
It's not a safe space. It's not a secure space. None of that. And if that when a university isn't a home, that's not what it is. It's a place to be confronted by, I would say, often horrible ideas. You want to learn about history? You think that's going to be safe? Do you know what human history is like? It's an endless bloodbath with a certain amount of hopeful progress underlying it. It's a horror show. And great literature is like that. And biology is terrifying. And physics is terrifying. And you want to be safe. It's stay home. Stay home with your mom. Stay home with your dad. Don't come to university if you want to be safe.
Because don't even go outside.
No, if the university is going to make you safe, then it ceased to be a university. So one of the things I try to do in my class, I have this class called Maps of Meaning, which concentrates on atrocity, basically, on Soviet atrocity and Nazi atrocity mostly. And what I try to do in the class is to teach my students that had they been in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, they would have been Nazis. And had they been offered the opportunity to be an Auschwitz camp guard, then maybe they would have leapt at it. And maybe they would have been in the more sadistic proportion of the Auschwitz camp guard population. You think that makes you feel safe? It doesn't make you feel safe to know that Nazis were humans and you happen to be one of them. And so I think that educators that tell students that they're offering them a safe space are doing them a profound disservice. And you don't... I'm a clinical psychologist, and here's one of the things you do to make people less afraid. You don't make the world safer. What you do is people tell you what they're afraid of, and then you break it into little bits so that they can go confront them. You know, so maybe they're afraid of going to a party, and you break that down. You say, well, do you know how to introduce yourself? And they say, well, I don't really even know how to shake someone's hand. And so then you practice having them shake their hand and introduce themselves because maybe they weren't taught by their half-witted parents when they were young because they were ignored. And so then you say, well, maybe you can go to a party for half an hour and all you have to do is introduce yourself to two people and we'll call that success. And you build up their competence and their confidence one step at a time. And what happens, the clinical literature indicates quite clearly, is you don't make people less anxious by doing that. You make them braver. It's not the same thing. You don't make the world and its horrors smaller. You make the person and their capacity to deal with horror larger. You encourage them. You strengthen them. That's what you do at a university. You arm people with arguments. You hone their intellect. You help them learn to write so they can marshal their arguments. You help them learn how to engage in intellectual combat, because that's better than engaging in real combat. And you make them hard and strong. You don't mollycoddle them and make them safe unless you're their enemy, unless you're trying to devour their spirit. And that's what we have in the universities. We have the reign of the Oedipal mother, who's answered everything is, oh, just come a little closer, dear, and I'll protect you from the world. It's just like Hansel and Gretel's, the witch in the Hansel and Gretel story. Well, my house is made of gingerbread. Just come in here and everything will be fine. Well, she feeds you candy to fatten you up so she can eat you. That's the archetype of a modern university.
When did this start? When did the trigger warnings, when did the safe spaces, when did all this emerge?
Well, it has its roots in the student radicalism of the 1960s, especially the far-left radicalism. It really popped up in the 1990s, in the early 90s, when I was teaching in the U.S. at that point. And
which university?
I taught at Harvard from 93 to 98. And there was a fair push for political correctness, especially in the early part of the 90s. But it got pushed back down and disappeared and went underground. It went underground is more accurate. And then it's just come back with a vengeance in the last 5 years. And I think it's partly because we have all these radical left political activist departments at the universities, women's studies being at the top of the list, that have done nothing for the last 30 years. It's even longer than that now. It's almost 40 years. 30 years, let's say. Have done nothing but produce a never-ending stream of ideologically minded counter-civilization political activists. And that's all subsidized by tuition and by the public purse. And that's another thing we really got to ask ourselves, is why the hell are we subsidizing revolution? Why are we doing that? It's crazy. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous.
What exactly is going on with women's studies that you believe is fostering revolution?
Well, you go on their websites and read what they say. I mean, first of all, for the women's studies types, and this is what would you call it? False anthropology. There's this idea that way back when there was a feminist paradise, and that would be like noble savage mode of living where everything was egalitarian and women dominated. It was a matriarchal culture. And that was put forward by a UCLA anthropologist named Gembutes. I can never pronounce her name properly, but I think I got it. And then that was overthrown by patriarchal institutions, starting at about the time, say, of Judaism. And that was all overthrown. And ever since then, we've lived in an oppressive patriarchy. And now that's what our culture is. It's an oppressive patriarchy.
So they're pointing to one unsuccessful society that they believe existed, or did it exist?
No, it didn't exist. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. It's complicated, but it's the telling of a kind of psychological myth as if it was history.
Whoa.
And anyway, so the basic claim is that Western civilization is a brutish patriarchy, and that whatever positive things it might have managed to accomplish were all accomplished as a consequence of oppression and theft, and that the appropriate thing to do is to restructure it from the bottom up. And they mean that. They mean that. They mean every single bloody concept. And you can marry that with modern postmodernism and throw in a nice dash of Marxism, and you have the ideological and motivated grounds for social revolution. And just go online and look at a dozen women's studies websites. Just read them. You can see what they say. They produce political activists, and they're goal is to restructure the patriarchy. Well, what's the patriarchy? Well, the patriarchy is Western civilization. And what does restructure mean? That's easy. It means tear it down and destroy it. Why? Because it's a brutish system that's predicated on nothing but oppression. It's nothing but a tyranny in the eyes of the of the radical women's studies types. Heterosexuality, that's a tyranny. Capitalism, that's a tyranny. Democracy, well, that doesn't even exist, and even if it did, it would be a tyranny. Everything's a tyranny. And so you can ask these, and what would they replace it with? They replace it with their own ideological utopia. Well, we've already had 100 years of that. We saw what happened. Oh, well, that doesn't matter. That wasn't real Marxism. That's what the bloody Marxists always say. That wasn't real Marxism. It's like, oh, how many millions of people have to die before you're convinced that it's real Marxism? And I know what they mean by that, too. They mean, hey, if I was the Marxist dictator, things would have gone a lot better. It's like, you should think again, sunshine. If you were the Marxist dictator, things wouldn't have gone a lot better. So, and if you're the sort of person that thinks that if you would have been in control, things would have gone a lot better, then you're exactly the sort of person who should never be in control. So, and it's resentment. It's horrible resentment, you know?
Well, that's an important point, because I think this is something that you've said that I absolutely agree with, that I think a lot of this thinking and the way people are behaving, it seems based on revenge. It seems based on revenge for awkward upbringings, social uncomfortability. It seems like there's something about the way they view the world where they want to get back at people that have literally done them no wrong.
It's resentment for the burden of being. It's deeper. I mean, human existence is characterized by a fair bit of suffering. You know, we're limited creatures and life is very hard. Everyone dies. Everyone you love is going to die. Most of the things you do, all of the things you do will eventually fail. You know, suffering is a certainty, and it's very easy for people to become resentful about being, about existence. You know, these kids who shoot up high schools and these mass shooters, they're the perfect examples of people who run on nothing but resentment. They're out to kill the innocent because that's the best marker of, that's the best way of showing just how much contempt they have for existence itself. Why punish the guilty? They deserve to be punished. It's a lot more malevolent and vengeful to punish the innocent. It's like people are motivated to a great degree by resentment of being. And a huge chunk of that is manifested in, that's the dark side of ideological possession. So I get to decide who my enemies are, and then I get to go after them, and I can go after them for every single thing that's ever been done to me that isn't good. And well, a lot of that's just built into the structure of existence.
Then they group up. They exhibit confirmation bias. They all form some sort of a groupthink, and then they act accordingly. And this is what you've been warning against, and this is where I completely agree with you, and this is why I think the subject is so important, and I love the way you've outlined all the steps and the problems with Marxism and ideologies in general, that we are dealing with this. These are the beginning steps of it, and people who look at it now and they say it's social change, it's social justice. It's not. It's not.
It's not. That's right. It's not. And this is not going to improve things. Implementing these policies will make things worse. They've made things worse every single place they've ever been implemented. And often they've made things so much worse that you actually can't imagine it. And people don't do the reading. I've done the reading. I know how bad things can get. They can get so bad that no matter how bad you think they are, you're not even in the bloody ballpark.
Well, it's just so strange that these sort of courses and these sort of ideologies are thriving in universities. And it's really disconcerting to someone who has children. Mm-hmm. And you know that your children are going to go there and they're going
to
be exposed to these
school.
Ideas.
You know, I think that...
Wow,
I think
a guy who used to teach at Harvard just says send him to trade school.
I think you can make a reasonable case that the universities do more harm than good now. I hate to say that.
Well, this is a strange time where access to information is so incredibly easy. You could educate yourself
right,
seemingly endlessly online, and with books, and just there's so much information available. This is not the 1930s. It's not a time where it was difficult to get an education outside of a university.
Well, the university, which is like the repository of human wisdom. And the attempt to expand that may have already moved outside the universities. You know, just because an institution calls itself a university doesn't mean it is. And many disciplines have turned into ideological factories. And so where's the university? I mean, the university is where anyone wants to learn about their culture and where anyone wants to expand the domain of human competence. And a lot of that's happening online now. So maybe that's the future. The only thing the universities have now, I think, that people can't get elsewhere is accreditation. But they're doing everything they can as fast as possible to make their accreditation valueless anyways. So, yeah, it's a terrible thing to say that the universities may do more harm than good, and I haven't come to that conclusion lightly.
Well, there's also,
I hate to say it.
I'm sure you do. There's also a gigantic financial stake, the amount of money that you're...
Well, this is especially the case in the U.S. I mean, one of the things that's happened over the last 30 years is that the proportion of university expenditures that's gone to the administration has massively, massively increased. And at the same time, the student loan burden has increased. And so what's happened in a weird sense is that the administrators have conspired to steal the future earnings of their students. And then you can't declare bankruptcy. So to me, it's indentured servitude.
Well, you can't declare bankruptcy on student loans.
Right.
That's
a very important distinction. That's right. You cannot declare bankruptcy on student loans. So you think about that. You tell me what difference there is between that and indentured servitude.
There's not much, because it's the only thing that I can even think of where that's the case.
Corporations can go bankrupt.
Right.
They do it all the time.
Individuals can. Businesses can fail. You can be deemed incompetent or not capable of paying your debt in every other case, but not with universities.
Yep, right.
That is crazy.
It is crazy.
It's crazy because they were just trying to combat the issue where so many kids were defaulting on their student loans. They try to make you perpetually responsible for it. Or, you know, the idea is that these kids have to learn responsibility. Is that the way to do it? By overcharging them for some useless education?
Well, I would
education?
Also say that it's not a particularly useful to burden your citizenry with a massive debt as soon as they graduate, at a time when they're most likely to take entrepreneurial risks.
Yes.
You know, you're not going to take entrepreneurial risks if you're so burdened with debt you can't get yourself off the ground.
Yeah, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt with people that if you're lucky, you're going to make, what, $40,000, $50,000 a year straight out of college? If you're lucky. So you're dealing with the amount of money that you would have to make if you didn't pay any taxes or didn't have any expenses. You'd have to work for 4 or 5 years, longer than you would actually be in college to get that degree in the first place. It's insane.
Yeah,
it's insane.
I would say, too, to the university students who are listening, like a lot of your professors are Marxists. Ask them. Ask them if they're Marxists. Read the Gulag Archipelago first, because you need to get your arguments together. And Solzhenitsyn won a Nobel Prize for that book and for his other writing. And it was one of the key, there was a couple of things that brought down the Soviet Union, but one of them was Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, and he demolished the intellectual credibility of Marxism forever. But you have to read the damn book, and you got to get your arguments in order, and you go after your Marxist professors. Ask
them.
And
it's a difficult book to read.
It's a very difficult book to read. It's a very difficult book, although it's difficult because it's so horrifying. It's not difficult particularly because it's impenetrable. In fact, it's an absolutely fascinating book in the same way that a terrible horror story is fascinating. But there's no excuse for this. There's no excuse for these professors who claim to be benevolent Marxists.
I think the way you framed it is very important. I think the way you framed it is them being compassionate intellectuals that are inclined toward this, because on the surface it seems like it's what a compassionate intellectual would support.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the unthinking adherence to compassion as the highest moral virtue.
And it's also, whenever you have an ideology, whenever you have these rigid established forms of communication or methods of thinking, You box people in. You box people in, and you control them, and you get them to stick inside that ideology. And in doing so, you suppress people. It's so ironic that the people that are against suppressing are actually suppressing people through enforcing these ideologies and suppressing the marketplace of free ideas. You're not allowed to have free ideas. You're not allowed to debate these things. I mean, I've seen – there was that really famous instance at the University of Toronto where this one guy – I don't even remember
Warren
what his book –
Warren Farrell.
Yes. What was
Why
his
Men
book
Make
about?
More.
Yeah, Why Men Make More.
Yeah, it was a multivariate analysis of the income disparity between men and women. He used to be a feminist activist. He decided to go look into the claim that, you know, women were making, I think at the time it was 70 cents for every dollar that men were making. He thought, well, I have daughters. I better go check this out and see, you know, do a little bit of in-depth investigating. And what he found out was that there were many reasons for the disparity. And perhaps one of them was unfair discrimination, but there were another dozen, and they seem to account for more of the disparity than the discrimination. I mean, just the fact that men take the more dangerous jobs is a huge contributor to that. And it's not trivial. You should get paid more if you're putting your limbs on the line. You know, I mean, I grew up in northern Alberta where a lot of young men dropped out of school and went and worked on the oil rigs. It's like, you go try that. Well, maybe you could do it. But, you know, the guys would lose their fingers. They'd lose their toes. It was 40 bloody below up there, and they'd be wrestling pipe in the middle of the bush.
I have a friend who does it. I have a friend who does that in northern Alberta.
Right.
It's horrific.
It is. It's tough work, man. And you're out in the bush for 2 weeks.
Hey, when you go outside, there's temperatures where you literally can't be outside of your truck for more than 30 minutes.
Right.
You have to jump back in the truck, and you're almost dying.
That was called life where I grew up.
You're listening to Jordan Peterson's first appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience in November 2016. Now back to the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, those are very difficult jobs, and they're very high paying because people die.
Yeah, they're hard work.
And there's not a lot of women taking those jobs.
No, and a good thing, too.
So this guy, I'm sorry, what is his name again?
Warren Farrell.
Warren Farrell, who wrote this book, was giving a speech about this book, and the response was so unbelievably violent and crazy and aggressive and also ignorant. Ignorant to what he was saying. Ignorant and not wanting to debate the facts, but wanting to call him a misogynist, wanting to call this hate speech. And
yeah, that's a favorite, man. And I got accused of that twice in the last 2 months because I don't want to use these compelled pronouns. It's
The one woman in the debate that you had with the other man that I believe is transsexual, the one woman who was trying to say, what is the difference between not using those words and using racial slurs and hate speech to describe these people? Like, the idea that that's a woman who's a professor, who's expressing it in that way. What is the difference between not choosing to use made-up pronouns versus calling someone generally accepted racial slurs?
Yeah.
That they're trying to frame that as the same thing.
Well, and the
it's
racial,
so intellectually dishonest.
Well, the racial slurs are also legal. So what's happening is the law is already such that not using one of these made-up pronouns is a crime, whereas using a racial epithet isn't.
Wow. That's crazy. So you could use the N-word.
No, it's legal to. Yes.
But you can't use, you have to say Zier.
Yeah.
You have to say Z. Ooh. Wow. This is crazy. This is really crazy. This is a bizarre moment in time where
it is bizarre.
The preposterous nature of it is so undeniable that it's forcing a lot of people. And I applaud you for doing what you're doing and risking your status with the university, risking your support of your peers, and sticking your neck out the way you've been doing with your YouTube videos. Because if you hadn't done that, there's a lot of people who wouldn't be aware of how insidious and what you were describing earlier, the creep, the slow creep towards pushing forward, waiting for you to object, waiting, and then moving forward a little bit more once you relax.
Yeah.
Because that's what this is.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been bizarre, I can tell you that. I mean, my son and I counted the number of press articles that have been devoted to this. These are serious press articles. This doesn't count YouTube or radio or TV or any of those things. And I mean, the YouTube coverage has been, I would say, overwhelming. There's been 170 major press articles written about those videos in the last 2 months.
And what's the general consensus? To begin with,
in the first 2 weeks, which was the most stressful part of this for me, I would say the bulk of the press articles ran contrary to my views, and their basic theme was something like, "Why doesn't the mean professor just play nice?" It was something like that. But luckily, fortunately, I seemed to maneuver past that. And then people started to actually read the policies that I was speaking about and started to think about them. And one thing about the press is that they're actually fairly in favor of free expression, given that that's their absolute bread and butter. And so the tenor shifted, and I would say the overwhelming majority of press articles in the last, apart from the first 2 weeks, have been positive.
Well, that's great. What you've done in your YouTube videos, which I think is an amazing forum, particularly for what you're doing, is document and describe in great detail the issues with every single one of these problems with no interruption. And I think that's one of the best things about it. The fact that there's not really a whole lot of forums that will give you the chance to express yourself. I've seen some of your videos have hundreds of thousands of views. Mm-hmm. And there's not a whole lot of forums where you can do that and speak for, they're all like an hour long, right?
Mm-hmm, I know.
I mean, it's amazing.
It is amazing. I started posting my lectures on YouTube, my classroom lectures in 2013. And in really bare bones form, they're just an iPad recording of me lecturing. I didn't edit in the slides or the images, partly because that's very time consuming. But then I watched it for about 2 years, and by September of this year, it had climbed to about 1 million views. And then I really started thinking about YouTube, because YouTube was cute cat videos, you know, and Justin Bieber songs for a very long period of time. But it's not that anymore. And that's probably been about 2 years or maybe 2.5 years. But then I realized that YouTube is actually a revolution that's as overwhelming as the Gutenberg press revolution. Gutenberg invented the printing press. And because for the first time in human history, a lecture can have the same reach and the same longevity as a book. And it's a lot easier for people to listen. And the time lag to publication is basically zero, right? I mean, because you can do it live, I guess, as we are right now, or you can post it in a day or two after publishing it, and you have access to this insanely large audience. And the other thing that's really interesting about YouTube with regards to my, especially the more academic videos, is there's only one reason that people are watching them. One. It's not the production quality. The audio is okay, and I'm a good speaker, but it's not the production quality. The reason they're watching them is because they want to know. And that's something that's really cool about YouTube. And YouTube also seems to be quite skeptical about advanced production values. You know, the people who are popular are often people like you who are basically sitting there talking, and everyone's listening. It's like, oh, well, people are actually talking about something, and this turns out to be interesting. It's like the rebirth of genuine journalism. So, yeah, YouTube's a... God only knows what YouTube is, but
well, I think
it's
the internet
a social
in general,
revolution.
I believe you're right. And I think the internet in general is this really new thing in terms of the ability to express yourself. I mean, it's only existed for 20-plus years, and in terms of human history, that's a blink of an eye. And it's only really been used, as you've described, over the last couple of years in this form. And I think it also is responsible, I think, for a great deal of the rise of the popularity of the social justice movement. I think it's a double-edged sword. I think these echo chambers and these people that do find these patterns of behavior that they subscribe to. And I think that's a part of the problem with ideologies in general, is that instead of thinking for yourself, you subscribe to a predetermined pattern of behavior and you lock in, like, this is what I'm supposed to believe, this is what I'm supposed to enforce, this is what I'm supposed to side with, and you go with that. One of the good things about the internet is that it is potentially possible to see contrary viewpoints and analyze them in the comfort of your own home and being by yourself and looking at maybe one of your videos, and maybe someone would come to you, and I'm sure a lot have come to your videos in anger, mad at you, and then listen to your points of view and listen to how clearly you've established all of these positions and what you actually feel is the problem with these positions in a very very calm and very rational and a very well-educated point of view. I think these people, they have the potential to be at least informed.
I've had lots of letters, obviously, maybe, I don't know, 2,500 letters maybe to my email accounts now about this, and a very large number of them, maybe 200 letters, 150 to 200, have been from people on the radical left who've written to me and said that they can no longer speak. Because the authoritarian types, the PC authoritarians, have got so controlling that their once fashionable position has now been deemed unacceptable, and they're alienated and excluded. I mean, you see that happening with feminists like Germaine Greer. I mean, Germaine Greer, who's been banned from campuses, she's not very happy with the idea that being a woman is something that's been reduced to a whim, right? Because she thinks that there's more to being a woman than mere subjective choice. Well, that's no longer a tenable viewpoint on the left. And so people who hold that viewpoint, many of them are feminists, are no longer getting along with the, say, radical gender bender activist types who've got center stage at the moment. So,
yeah, Christine Summers has the same issue with that. She's a feminist, and she calls herself the factual feminist, and she pushes back against. And what her perspective is instead of embracing these false narratives and running with them as if they're the facts and just using that to reinforce your ideology, she's saying that does feminism a disservice. Let's look at the actual reality of the situation, and let's look at it from a balanced and objective perspective. And she gets so much hate for that.
Yeah.
The idea of being rational and objective.
Well, that's because as far as the postmodern social justice warriors are concerned, those are just code words for oppression. There's no object. You've got to remember this with regards to having these sorts of arguments. When you say objective and rational, that's predicated on your implicit belief that there is such a thing as the objective and there is such a thing as rational. And the radical postmodernists, they do not buy that. Not at all. Not at all. As far as they're concerned, that's just another power game on your part. And built into the laws, like Bill C-16 in Canada now, and the same in the laws in New York City that govern the use of these gender pronouns, built into the law is the idea that there's no biological foundation for your identity, and that it's all purely subjective. They built that into the law. No objective reality, no biology. That's going to unfold over the next 20 years.
Or not. I mean, isn't it possible that these kind of discussions and that your videos and that all the people that agree and all the people that are pushing back against this can have some sort of an effect on this movement?
Or do you think it's inevitable? I would say yes. I mean,
are you cynical about the future?
No. I'm not at all cynical about the future. I am cynical about my ability to predict the future. Like when I was younger, much younger, back in the 1980s, I mean, I was very, very concerned about the possibility of nuclear war. But as we all were. By about the mid 90s, though, I realized that things were in such a state of chaotic flux that the one thing I could be certain of was that no matter what I was afraid of with regards to the future, that isn't what was going to happen. And so I'm not cynical about the future, but I do believe that we're in an unprecedented state of indeterminacy and flux, and God only knows what could happen. Having said that, I wouldn't say I'm optimistic about the possibility that the universities will reform themselves, because I think that, well, even with the free speech debate that the University of Toronto hosted, they did three politically correct things during the debate, which I thought was really interesting, because if I would have staged the debate and been working on their side, let's say, I would have said, strategically speaking, no politically correct maneuvering during this debate, because all it's going to do is discredit us. But that isn't what happened. The university opened up by noting that the land on which we were having the debate was once what was once property owned by the original Native Americans, which is something I find abhorrent, because on the one hand, we took it, and now on the other hand, we want to be friends. It's like, I don't think you get to have both sides of that moral play at the same time. But that's okay. That's how the university opened the debate. And then the next thing that happened was that they announced that there would be counselors waiting outside for anybody who was too traumatized by the contents of the discussion. And then they closed by announcing the Trans Day of Remembrance. You know, and the reason I'm pointing this out is because it just shows you the fact that those things happened. They weren't even strategic. That's just how things are at the university. And they didn't even notice that people were going to turn themselves inside out, noticing that, saying, well, God, this is so biased, I can hardly believe it, which is exactly what happened. That's how saturated the universities are with this kind of thinking. And I don't have any idea what can reverse that. Collective decisions on the part of citizens, A, to stop sending their children there, B, to stop donating money and leaving it in wills, and C, to pressure politicians. Like, in my wilder moments, I think, cut the funding to the universities by 25% and let the faculty have a war about what's important. And maybe what would be left over was what the university should be. But I really think it's, with the exception of the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics ends of things, I think it's come to that.
Don't you think that what you're doing when you're making these videos is, in a sense, branching out away from just a university and teaching online? Because you are.
Well, like I said, I think that, that you could make a case that that's where the university is. Because that's where people are going just to get knowledge. They have no other motivation.
And this is a new thing, obviously. But at one point in time, so is the printing press.
Right.
And this new ability to disseminate information seems to me to be more effective, more accessible, more reasonable.
Yeah.
And it's entirely possible that what we're looking at is the future of education.
Maybe. It could be. I mean, I've been spending a lot of time in the last month or so also concentrating on video editing. And so I spent about 10 hours this week editing about an hour discussion with a Russian Orthodox icon carver, weirdly enough, that I'm going to launch in the next 3 or 4 days. And we discussed things that are very image heavy. And so I've been cutting in a lot of images. And it is a technology that far supersedes what, I mean, I like lecturing, and lectures can be very effective. But basically with YouTube, you can turn your lecture into a documentary. And then instead of teaching 100 people, you can teach 50,000. It's like, that's a lot different. That's a lot different. And
it's
then
a lot
it's up
different.
There permanently.
Yes, and that 50,000 can grow and grow and grow. And as it becomes more spread and shared, the discussions about it become more varied.
Yeah. Well, more than 3 million people have watched some element of this in the last couple of months. And in September, I had about 9,000 subscribers. That took me about 2 years, 3 years to build. And one of my ambitions, which was kind of a tongue-in-cheek and comical ambition, is I thought, I bet I can get more subscribers in the next 3 years than the U of T has students. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. It's like all of a sudden I could have a body of students, let's say, that's larger than the entire university. It's like, just exactly what the hell does that mean? And the answer to that is, I don't know what that means. Who knows what that means? But one of the other perverse things that happened while I was being warned and cautioned by the university was that my subscriber base grew from 9,000 to 65,000. So now I have more YouTube subscribers than the University of Toronto has students. It's like, so then I think, well, hell, I could do a whole series on Solzhenitsyn. I could do a whole series on George Orwell. I could do a whole series on Aldous Huxley. I could do a whole series on archetypal biblical stories. And half of me thinks, well, if 50,000 people are going to watch each of those and I can turn them into documentaries instead of just lectures, maybe that's what I should be doing. Like, I couldn't write a book with that much reach. That's crazy reach.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's revolutionary. I believe that. I believe it's revolutionary.
I believe it is, too, and I believe no one saw it coming. And I think it's such a new thing that we're all just sort of starting to get a handle on how to use it and what it's capable of.
Yes, well, it was like the internet was for pornography. Well, that changed quick. And YouTube was for cute cat videos. And that changed quick, too. You don't know what the technology is going to do.
Well, it's also, I don't know how much you've paid attention to virtual reality or how much you've experimented with it, but my good friend Duncan Trussell has one of those HTC Vives, and I put it on over his house. He runs a podcast, and we played with it for about an hour and a half, and then we did a podcast, and I'm thoroughly convinced, especially now with new phones. There's a phone that I just got called the Google Pixel, and it comes, you can buy it with this headset. Mm-hmm. You slide the phone into the headset, you put on this virtual reality program, and you're watching a virtual reality show on your phone. I mean, a regular phone that fits in your pocket just slides into this headset.
Yep.
You could do not just a two-dimensional thing where you're showing a lecture and showing images and having a discussion and putting these images in the background or in the foreground and have the audio over it, but rather you could have three-dimensional things where you could show a city, a village, a mountain range. You could show geometric patterns. You could get involved in – I mean, it could be used for a million different things, and not just for entertainment but also for education.
Yeah.
And I think that is that's the next step, I think. I mean, it's an unbelievably fascinating new world.
Well, you must be shocked to some degree at how popular your podcasts have become. I mean, you have, I don't know how many people on YouTube have a larger subscriber base than you, but it's not that many. So I mean, how do you account for that? And does that surprise you?
It's surprising, but it's this whole podcast thing is very surprising. But it's the YouTube is only a small fraction of the amount of people that actually listen to the podcast.
Right.
The numbers, the downloads are insane. Jamie, what was last month's numbers?
YouTube was around 12 million for the month, and audio is at 60 million.
Wow. Yeah, and I haven't played anywhere near enough with turning my online lectures into podcasts either.
You definitely should. You definitely should. It's, I mean, a lot of it you could listen to when you're in a car.
Right, or when you're exercising or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I know. You're not glued to a screen with the podcasts.
No, I was doing some work around my office when I was listening to one of yours, one of your things on YouTube, and I found that it was just as interesting if I was doing some other things around my office.
Like, yeah.
It's a very good passive, like podcasts themselves are a very good passive form of education.
Yes, absolutely.
Or entertainment.
Well, and that makes them different than reading.
Yeah.
You know, because reading is faster if you're a good reader, but
right.
You can't do anything else while you're doing it.
Right.
But people are much more naturally attuned to listening than they are to reading.
Yeah.
Because we've only been reading, really, human beings have only been reading, roughly speaking, in any large numbers for 500 years.
Right.
Right. It's a blink of the eye. Whereas we've been listening for a very, very long period of time. And all this new technology, like, well, it puts us back into tribal mode, basically, except with this incredible technological enhancement.
It wouldn't be difficult at all to extract the audio from any of these YouTube videos and just start putting it online as a podcast. And again, you know, people could listen to it when they're in traffic, when
yep.
they can't look at anything,
yep. Yep.
on planes, on the bus, you know, wherever you are, where you can just sit down and you can close your eyes and you don't have to be paying attention to it visually.
Yeah, well, about 4 or 5 months ago, I emailed the University of Toronto because they have a kind of a massive online course branch, which they're toying with. And I said, look, I've got 1 million people who've watched my videos. Like, maybe you guys should give me a hand. We should do something about this because I got 1 million people who are watching these videos. It's like, that's a significant number of people. It's worth attending to. But perhaps I contacted the wrong people, but I never did get a response. But it's something I'm doing it actively right now. And I think the quality of my videos has improved substantially in the last month. And I really like doing the video editing, although it's very painstaking. But it's definitely, the universities better be careful because they're dumping their content online as fast as they can. They're going to make themselves completely superfluous. And some smart person, I've been thinking about this for 20 years, is going to take over the accreditation end. Because, you know, all you'd have to do is set up a series of well-designed examinations online and only let a minority of people pass. You have instant accreditation credibility. It's like, here's an entire 3 years worth of psychology courses. Here's the exams. You take them. Only 15% of the people pass.
Why only 15%? Why would you limit the number?
Because it makes the accreditation valuable.
But you would limit the number based on, what if you had a much larger group than 15% that were effectively absorbing the information?
Well, fair enough. You'd have to toy with the accreditation mechanisms. But I mean, part of the utility in accreditation is that it's inequality. If everyone gets accredited, then the accreditation is worth
nothing. But wouldn't you just make it difficult?
Because that's what you do. Make it difficult.
Yeah, but
it's,
I mean,
just
instead
a proxy
of limiting
for difficulty.
Right. Okay. So you wouldn't necessarily be limiting the number. You would just make it so difficult that the number would be limited almost
that's
naturally.
Right, that's right. Well, I think that's exactly right. I wouldn't limit the number of times people could take the exams.
That's a great idea as well.
So as long as you hit threshold, I mean, that's what happens often, say, with if you're trying to pass the bar or something like that. You get to take it a number of times, but you have to hit threshold.
Well, Thaddeus Russell, who's a history professor at Occidental, he's doing that very same thing. He talked about it here, that he's building right now an online university. And he is planning on giving out degrees in history through his online university because he's been teaching at universities for a long time, and he has a huge problem also with the politically correct movement. And he was speaking out against this really crazy story where these two kids, adults, got intoxicated and had sex. And because they were both intoxicated, for some reason the boy was described as the attacker and was being accused of sexual assault even though it was consensual, completely consensual, even though they were both, not only did she sent him text saying, do you have condoms? Come on over. We're going to do this. But he, because they were intoxicated, he was the one that was the rapist, mm-hmm. which is insane. It's sexist. It's 100% sexist. That kid is suing, you know, and Thaddeus Russell came on here and discussed it. But that politically correct ideology where, I mean, it's essentially prejudice against men in that particular the idea that
so he's stepping outside of the university.
Yeah, he's slowly moving. I mean,
Gad Saad is doing that at Concordia too.
Yes,
and you know he gets 100,000 people watching his each video.
Yeah, he's
tremendous
been on here a few
power.
Times.
Yeah,
I love
yeah.
that guy. And again, he's another one who, like yourself, has stuck his neck out and spoke out about what he thinks is this preposterous movement towards denying facts, denying reality, and forming these narratives that are based on their ideologies and sticking within this box and then seeking to find people that agree with it and then reinforcing these ideas in this echo chamber. And it's just – it's a for someone who's outside of it, like myself, it's a fascinating thing to watch. For someone who's inside of it, like yourself, it must be maddening.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. My show runs every Friday this summer from 6 to 8 p.m. You are listening to Jordan Peterson on his first appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience in November 2016. Now back to the show.
Well, we've tried other online interventions too. So I have these YouTube videos up, but we also designed – I worked with some corporations a while back because I've done some consulting and I had designed tests to help people hire better employees. Which I still do. And in fact, I work with this company up in California called the Founder Institute, and it's the world's largest stage early technology company incubator. It's created 2,500 companies in the last 4 years, and we test now in 135 cities. But when I was marketing these tests to companies, they kept asking me what could be done about their poorer performing employees. And I said, well, I didn't know, because it's not that easy to, if you have someone who's problematic, who's troubled, it's not that easy for a manager to figure out how to straighten them out. And they just don't have the time. They don't have the time, they don't have the manpower, and they don't have the training usually to do that. But I designed this set of programs called the Self-Authoring Suite. And one of them, the Future Authoring Program, helps people write out a plan for their life. So it helps them. It asks you some questions about six dimensions of your life, you know, your health, mental and physical, your use of drugs and alcohol, your wishes 3 to 5 years down the road for intimate relationships, for family, for career, for education, and so on. It asks you, what could your life be like 3 to 5 years down the road if you set it up for you like you were someone you were taking care of? So it asks you those six questions. Then it asks you to write for 15 minutes about your vision for your life. You get to have what you want and what would be good for you. What would that be? And then it asks you to write for 15 minutes about what your life would be like 3 to 5 years down the road if you let your bad habits and your, you know, idiocies and your foolishnesses and your weaknesses take the upper hand and auger you into the ground. Because everyone knows about that. And so it's like you get to design a little heaven to strive for and a little hell to avoid. And then you write for, then you basically turn that into an implementable plan. That's the second part of the program. We've used that with about 5,000 to 7,000 university students now, mostly in Europe at the Rotterdam School of Management. And we've raised their grade point average of their kids 25%, dropped their dropout rate the same. And it's had a walloping effect on men and on non-Western ethnic minorities. It's moved the non-Western ethnic minority student population performance at Rotterdam School of Management from 70% below the average to above the female Dutch natives. And so the reason I'm telling you this, apart from the fact that it's a very good program, and we did it at Mohawk College in Canada a year ago, and we dropped their dropout rate in the first semester 50%. And that especially, again, worked well for men, because men are at more risk of dropping out now, and especially for men who didn't have good grades in high school. So not only is there the possibility for the net to provide tremendous dissemination of intellectual material, but there's also the possibility for the net to provide dissemination of psychological interventions that have major impacts on people's mental health and productivity at extraordinarily low cost. So that's really been fun too. So,
well, I think providing some that sort of a structure and a framework, giving people the tools just in form of asking them questions. What would you like to do?
Yep.
Please describe this. What is your future? And when you do that, you sort of allow them to help themselves outline what they would like to accomplish, which most people don't do.
No, well, in our education system, was designed in Chicago in the late 1800s to produce factory workers. Because it was set up when rural people were migrating to the cities en masse because their kids, first of all, were likely to get factory jobs. And second of all, if you were working in a factory, your kids needed to be taken care of. And so the purpose of the schools was to train factory workers, which is why everyone's lined